Welcome to episode 221 of the Microsoft Cloud IT Pro Podcast, recorded live on March 12th, 2021. This is a show about Microsoft 365 and Azure from the perspective of IT pros and end users, where we discuss a topic or recent news and how it relates to you. In this episode, we kick off the episode talking about Ben's first 24 hours with the M1 Mac Mini, and then we move into the general availability of Azure Routing Preference, as well as the preview release of Trusted Launch for Azure Virtual Machines. Hopefully the kids don't come barging in.
The kids are absolutely going to come barging in.
There we go. Now they'll just make more noise because they'll like knock the door down as they come barging in.
Tis the way of work at home life, right? Like we're all that like BBC dad from 4 years ago, just kids rushing through the doors and it's all part of the experience.
Yes. Although do you put your hand over their face and try to push them down out of the way or do you just like, well, your kids are too big to put on your lap.
I give up. I don't know. Like the printer's right behind me. So there's just random goings on. Like when they come home, like the wall behind me starts making noise, doors start slamming. They're all like hangry. It's a thing.
Well, and are they home? Is it spring break for them this week?
No, spring break is next week for them.
Okay.
It is spring break for my wife this week. And she was fortunate enough that the new federal program for vaccinations has kicked up in the United States. And yep. Earlier this week, so like late last week on Friday, they announced that teachers, any K-12 teacher or support staff were eligible for their vaccination. So she spent this week getting her appointment and going and getting vaccinated and at least getting her first shot, all
Got
that
it.
Stuff.
Nice. So has she been back to school? Has she been teaching in school? I don't know that I've even asked her. She's still been doing the remote thing. St. John's is pretty much back to all in person, right?
St. John's, I would say, never really did remote school, and Duval really never did it either. My wife is a special ed teacher. She does ESE, and the kids in her classroom, like they really do need to be in person.
Got it.
And she also teaches in a Title I portion of Duval. So Duval County in Florida is super large. Jacksonville, from a population perspective, pretty small. I think like 800,000 people in Jacksonville.
Yeah, it's something like that.
But it's spread out over a super wide area. And there's certainly pockets of affluent folks in Jacksonville and those who are not so affluent. And my wife happens to teach in one of the not so affluent areas. Right. So those kids don't even have like internet at home to be able to attend school remotely.
So it's all in person. Yes, yep. Jacksonville, it's a tangent, but Jacksonville from that whole population and people and size and all that is just a bizarre city.
Yeah. I always love when somebody asks like where you live. And, you know, if you live in New York, like New York State, you could say, oh, I live in New York. And somebody goes, New York City? And you go, no, New York State, upstate New York, western New York, something like that.
Yep.
You know, you go, Florida, I live in Jacksonville. And people just go like, oh, it's like a big blob on the dot. Like in reality, you and I live way further south, right? Like I almost live in St. Augustine compared to Jacksonville.
Yes, it's, yeah. And you go, so we did this once. Put people in perspective. We said it was big. I think I looked it up. I think it's about 950 square miles if you're in the US and deal with miles. If you're ever anywhere else in the world, go type it into Google and let them do the conversion to square meters, square kilometers. But we were driving once. So there's a highway that goes from the north. It goes like straight through Jacksonville. I-95 goes from DC down to Miami, but it goes right through the middle of Jacksonville. We were coming from somewhere up north, hit the Duval Jacksonville line on 95, and we actually went the speed limit. We were going like 65, 70, because it kind of changes as you go down. And we were going from the north end to the south end. No traffic, nothing. It legitimately took us 50 minutes to drive from the north end of Jacksonville to the south end of Jacksonville on the highway, going probably an average of 65.
Yep. So Jacksonville is pretty far north in the state of Florida. It's on the East Coast, on the Atlantic. And same thing, when you're coming back, like say you're up in Georgia, because we're pretty close to Georgia, and you cross the state line and you see the sign that says, "Welcome to Jacksonville," because you've crossed the Jacksonville city limit, you will not be in downtown Jacksonville for another 45 minutes with no traffic. It's crazy.
Yeah.
You just kind of keep driving and driving and driving.
It is. But yet it's so big that you have all these little pockets. So where we are in Jacksonville, we very rarely drive more than 5 minutes to get anywhere, unless we're going to visit a friend. But in terms of stores, like you have your typical Walmart, Target, down here it's Publix for groceries, or a Food Lion, fast food. Almost everybody in Jacksonville has that within like 5 or 10 minutes of their house. So even though Jacksonville's huge, unless you are working somewhere or going to visit somebody, you rarely drive more than 5 or 10 minutes to go anywhere, at least yeah. In my experience. I'm sure there might be parts where you have to drive further, but it's...
For me, it's like 30 minutes, 20, 30 minutes.
To get anywhere?
So like if I... But, you know, I can go to a grocery store in 5 minutes or less, but if I want to go to a Target, to like any kind of like major chain thing, yeah, it's a 20, 30 minute drive.
It's 20 to 30 for you. Okay.
Outlook add-ins are a great way to improve productivity and save time in the workplace, and Sperry software has all the add-ins you'll ever need. The Save as PDF add-in is a bestseller and is great for project backups, legal discovery, and more. This add-in saves the email and attachments as PDF files. It's easy to download, easy to install, and Sperry software's unparalleled customer service is always ready to help. Download a free trial at sperrysoftware.com, SperrySoftware.com, and see for yourself how great Save as PDF is. Listeners can get 20% off their order today by entering the code CLOUDIT. That's CLOUDIT, CLOUDIT, all one word at checkout. Sperry Software, work in email, not on email.
All that to say, now that everybody's learned about Florida and Jacksonville and Duval, I got a Mac. I got an M1.
We got it.
I don't know how we got from M1s to Jacksonville.
It's a long and sordid affair, but...
Yes, that it is. But it has been less than 24 hours, so I don't have a whole lot other than... So far, I've been impressed. It's quiet. Everything I have tried to do over the last 24 hours so far has worked well. I haven't had any issues with it. We will see. The only thing I ran into, and it was completely on me, because I knew the Mac Mini only supported 2 monitors. So I was like, okay, I got 1 monitor here, I got 1 monitor there. I have a 34-inch, a 27-inch. Great. What I failed to remember was that I use the Luna display adapter for my iPad for a teleprompter that I'm actually looking at as we record this. And lo and behold, Luna display is a 3rd monitor. So my teleprompter failed to work.
Because it projects itself as a physical device versus more software-driven devices, or like truly like 100% software driver devices, like the Display Links of the world. Like Display Links might have physical hardware, but they're ultimately bound to, at least on the Mac side, a virtual projection through their driver.
Yes. So I have a Display Link on the way, because I like to try all this stuff out. I have Luna. That's my primary one. Because it sees itself as a hardware device, it tends to be quicker and a little bit snappier than something like Duet Display or Sidecar. So I tried both of those. Duet Display works perfectly fine because, again, that one's software driven. Sidecar, same thing. But neither Sidecar nor Duet have all the proper settings to do the flipping and rotating and mirroring and all of that required to use an iPad as a teleprompter device.
To use an iPad with a teleprompter device.
Yes, to use the iPad as the screen projecting or reflecting off of the teleprompter.
You can certainly use your iPad as a teleprompter if you just want to like stand it up on a stand, but you're talking about putting it in a physical teleprompter.
Exactly.
Having the screen up and flipped so it's in the right orientation for you as the person who's looking at the teleprompter.
Yes. So as we record this, I can look into your eyes, Scott, while also looking into my camera.
Thanks. Nothing creepy about that, but yeah.
We're all friends. So yeah,
we're all friends here, sure.
I did not sleep enough last night. So yes, that is my story with the M1. But we'll see. I also want to try like recording some YouTube videos using the shotgun because now I no longer have the jet airplane fan in the 16-inch MacBook Pro running on my desk. But this was a good way for me to kind of test this out too, test out the M1, see how well it handles my workflow because I am going to use it. My goal is to keep the laptop closed. I'll maybe use it downstairs on the couch or any of that, but M1 Mac Mini is going to be what I do all of my work on and see how it holds up. And eventually I might replace the 16-inch with possibly an M1, or there are some very interesting rumors swirling about what is coming later this year in terms of some MacBook Pro refreshes. I may hold out for those because I figure if the M1 Mini can handle everything, anything coming after that will be able to handle it as well.
I'll be interested to see how you get on with this. So certainly as an administrator who lives in a cloud-based world, like, you know, you still need PowerShell and kind of all the things that come working in the Microsoft ecosystem there.
Yep.
I know for myself, I'm still bound to Windows for like several things that are just part of my daily work, like interacting with Excel spreadsheets that have macros or custom code in them, right? Like that tends to be something that, you know, immediately I have to go to a Windows VM and get on with. And I recognize that. That's, you know, something that I know is in front of me. But I'd be interested to hear what like does or does not work with Rosetta and everything else just as you're making that transition. So maybe we do like follow up in a month or a couple weeks here and see what that looks like for you.
Yes, we will have to do that. I did get Parallels running already with Windows 10 ARM-based. And we're going to have to see how it works.
That one's tough for me too, because there's no official installer for the Windows 10 ARM thing, right? You're taking the dev image.
The insider, like the VMX or VHDX. Yes. Off of the Windows Insider site. Yeah. I grabbed that, dropped it in there, fired right up. And then you can go grab all the Windows updates and continue doing the Windows updates, but it's not. Yeah, it's not like go grab an ISO and install it.
I think it's that, and it's just insider preview, and you know, your mileage may vary. And then emulation on top of emulation on top of emulation.
Let me tell you, the Teams client, because I did go try to install a few things. Windows are Office, Word, Excel, PowerPoint. Those installed, that's all I've done, is just does it install okay? The Teams client crashed out horrifically. There is an ARM-based Teams client. It did not work in Parallels on the Mac. I'm not sure why. I didn't have any time to figure it out because it was late last night. That crashed out on me. The other interesting thing I found, and then we'll dive into other stuff and do a follow-up later, is I went to install Edge Canary and Edge release. And now that Rosetta's installed, it's running. It's hard to know what's using it and what's not all the time. But I went to go download Edge and it asked me, are you using Apple Silicon or are you using Intel? And I said, I'm using the Apple chip, the Apple Silicon, the M1, downloaded it, clicked to install it, and it immediately asked me if I wanted to install Rosetta. I don't know if this is a marketing to figure out how much dev effort to put into it, and they just want to know which link people are clicking on. And really, it's downloading the same image and it's not fully optimized for the M1 yet, or if there's something else running in there that was requiring Rosetta, I don't know. But the Apple Silicon version of Edge does appear to still need Rosetta too.
Yes. So ARM, I'm trying to think where Edge is at. ARM 64 support, I believe, is out there for specifically Windows ARM. So like if you had a Surface Pro X. Yeah, Surface Pro X is the Windows ARM device. So if you had that, so like for you, you should go into your virtual machine and say, I want the Edge Canary ARM 64, and then you would get the right one there.
The right.
I'm not sure if it's available for M1 Max yet.
Yeah, I don't know either. But Other than that, a lot of software is prompting me. So I'll go grab installers. Either it's natively supported on M1 or it's saying you didn't download the M1 version. Do you want to go download it? So I think Zoom did that to me. Seems like there was something else. DaVinci Resolve now natively supports M1. So I made sure I grabbed that one. All the Office apps are native for M1. What else do I run on a daily basis? Oh, Parallels. I grabbed the wrong version of Parallels initially.
Yeah, you gotta be on the beta there.
Yes, that one sent me over to the beta to go download the M1. So by and large, I found software vendors are doing a pretty good job at either having betas out and detecting it and pointing you to the beta, or they just already natively support it. So
gotcha.
That is my M1 story, but yes, interesting experiment to follow up on in another month or so.
Absolutely.
Do you feel overwhelmed by trying to manage your Office 365 environment? Are you facing unexpected issues that disrupt your company's productivity? IntelliJink is here to help. Much like you take your car to the mechanic that has specialized knowledge on how to best keep your car running, IntelliJink helps you with your Microsoft Cloud environment because that's their expertise. IntelliJink keeps up with the latest updates in the Microsoft Cloud to help keep your business running smoothly and ahead of the curve. Whether you are a small organization with just a few users up to an organization of several thousand employees, they want to partner with you to implement and administer your Microsoft Cloud technology. Visit them at IntelliJink.com/podcast. That's IntelliJink.com/podcast for more information or to schedule a 30-minute call to get started with them today. Remember, IntelliJink focuses on the Microsoft Cloud so you can focus on your business.
So, on to some cloud news. You go first.
I go first.
Just to throw you on the spot.
Not a problem at all. So I'm actually super excited about something that has become generally available in Azure, and specifically Azure Routing Preference is now GA. There's this capability within Azure to basically control where your traffic will go ahead and egress from Microsoft's network. So normally the way this works is in its default state, like your traffic would route over the Microsoft global network. So I'll take like storage account because storage is near and dear to my heart at this point in my life.
You do a little bit with storage?
A little bit with storage these days. But if I take a storage account and I want to go ahead and say like download a file out of there, right? I have a blob that sits in storage and I want to download that out. If my storage account is over in West Europe, it's sitting in Amsterdam, and I'm sitting here on the East Coast of the United States, and I just go over the public internet, like I fire up AZ Copy or Storage Explorer, something like that, or I just go to my web browser, like I have a public URI to it, I go ahead and download that blob. What happens is it actually routes the blob for egress over Microsoft's network, and it will egress at the closest POP to me. So Microsoft has a bunch of POPs, points of presence, all over the world. And what that means is I would come out at a POP over here on the East Coast of the United States, which generally means I'm getting the lowest latency that I can for that egress, where I've gone ahead and said, I want to travel and traverse Microsoft's backbone from Europe over to the United States. And then I want to egress out on the US side and hit the public internet closest to me from the client side. Now, to a certain, like in that scenario, you are part of your charge and part of what you're paying for with Azure is the ability to route over that backbone, right? And have that traffic get to you as quick as it can. And that's all well and good.
Yep.
And you might want that in a bunch of scenarios that can be helpful to you. In some cases, you might not want to do that. Latency might be okay for you, and you might want it to be a little cheaper. Or maybe you already work with a partner where you can egress out over their network and simplify things and make it a little easier. So that's what Routing Preference does. It lets you choose how your data egresses from Azure, whether it's something like a storage account or it could be a public IP that's associated with a virtual machine. So when I hit this public IP, any traffic that comes through it should also go out it, and it should go directly out over the public internet. So you have this choice now where you can choose whether data traverses over Microsoft's network and egresses at the POP closest to the user, or if it goes ahead and egresses basically directly as close as it can to the region where your service is hosted. And because you're egressing over the internet quicker, your charge for egress, like your networking charge for data egress charges, becomes lower because now, you know, you don't need to have that additional overhead and any associated billing meters that come with traversing the Microsoft network. Now, the cool thing that's happening here, like in my case in storage, right, we've got CDNs and things like that available to us, or maybe you work with a CDN partner. CDN partners have the ability to come to Microsoft and effectively purchase this thing called routing preference unmetered. And routing preference unmetered then lets you go ahead and egress out over like a CDN network, and then you just have your charges with your CDN provider and things like that. It's a super cool offering in that it just gives you as a customer that choice over where your data egresses. So you can pick whether you're doing like cold potato routing or hot potato routing. And depending on that choice, you know, there's those various trade-offs of how much you potentially spend for a given billing meter and latency and performance for the workload that you have in front of you.
Interesting. There was something I was going to say. Oh, so the other thing I'm imagining that would also come into play here is we talk about the POPs and going out over the internet versus going over Microsoft's backbone. As I'm guessing other people might also care about potential, I don't know if I necessarily want to say security implications, but if you're going out as soon as possible, you're possibly jumping through a lot more ISPs, a lot more companies, as that data goes from Microsoft to you, rather than staying kind of on that internal secure network. So you also probably don't know what networks it's necessarily going over to get from that POP to you if you're doing the routing via the ISP networks.
To a certain degree, sure, right? You are going to egress. But I think in the case of some of the stuff I've seen, at least kind of early on with this,
yep.
If I'm hosting my, you know, I develop a product hey, we spent all that time talking about like your M1 and you had to get all the installers for things.
Yep.
Like if I'm an ISV and I host my installers in object storage or blob storage, you know, that stuff's got to traverse the public internet at some point.
Right. And you're not really going to care where it comes out there.
Yeah, maybe I want it to egress faster, so my charges for egress are lower. And yeah, then my customers are subject to latency if maybe their ISP plus some others. But that can be an acceptable trade-off, right? When it comes to figuring out kind of that seesaw of cost versus performance and where you want to be. And it's not an all or nothing proposition. It's a service by service proposition, right? So storage account by storage account, public IP by public IP, things like that. What do you want to do with it? And how do you want to set that up? So it's GA, it's out there today. It's available for virtual machines and including kind of supersets of virtual machines like VMSS or virtual machine scale sets. AKS is available. Internet facing load balancers also can take advantage of this capability, as can App Gateway, Azure Firewall. And then for storage, the way storage works is you're actually going to end up with two endpoints on your storage account. You'll end up with one that can still egress over Microsoft POPs, and you'll end up with an additional endpoint. Like you get a new URI that's provisioned for your storage account. So say I was like, you know, scott.blob.core.windows.net. I would have scott-internetrouting.blob.core.internet.windows.net. And I could do either of those and I could pick and choose where I egress. So for storage, it's for blobs, files, websites, static websites, that could be helpful there,
yep.
And data lakes as well, which is pretty cool.
Got it. So for a lot of those, you just get two endpoints now. and you just pick and choose which endpoint you want to use. So
for storage specifically, you always keep your primary endpoint, and your primary endpoint will always use the Microsoft global network. And then when you enable routing preference, it gives you a secondary endpoint. So you have to make sure that you are going down the path of, like, you know, if you're connecting to your storage account by URI, that you're connecting over that secondary endpoint. So you do get that control in there.
Got it. So this isn't also going to be available then for every service out of the gate. Different services are going to have to go turn it on. Like, I also think about,
correct,
you have like all your different Azure SQL stuff and all those various services. You might be waiting for this to get enabled for a service you use.
This has been out in preview and it's GA'd. So this is kind of like V1. It will improve over time and get new features. But today it's primarily constrained to storage and like public IPs and VIPs that are associated with load balancers and things like that.
Got it. So anything you can put a public IP address on and your storage. Nifty.
Yep.
Very cool. Yeah, I can see some definite benefits there and some clients that might even switch over to that to save some cost.
So, Scott, do you know how many files are shared outside your organization? Or are you sure that every team in your Microsoft 365 tenant has a valid owner? Guess what? ShareGate's got your back. After helping thousands of customers move to Office 365, they've learned that success in the cloud involves more than just migration. That's why they created ShareGate Apricot, an automated governance platform for Microsoft Teams and Microsoft 365 groups. ShareGate Apricot can help you answer questions like these without planning unnecessary restrictions on your users. With ShareGate Apricot, you get full visibility across each team's lifecycle from creation all the way through to archival. You can automate manual tasks involved in identifying problem areas like inactive or orphan teams. And you can collaborate with team owners on corrective measures to keep your teams tidy and secure. That's also why they've combined ShareGate Desktop, their trusted migration and content management tool, with ShareGate Apricot in a single subscription so that you have everything you need to be successful in the Microsoft cloud.
Oh, what else do we have?
Well, I can keep going. Like, there's been a bunch of cool stuff that we just haven't had a chance to talk about.
There has been. Keep going. We have a few minutes left. The other things I have are going to drastically switch topics, so we can save those and keep going with Azure. Because you also sent me this article about trusted launch for Azure VMs. Is that where you're going next?
Yeah. Do you want to do trusted launch or flexible orchestration?
Wow. I don't know. I like VMs, but I have no idea what flexible orchestration is. So you can educate me, or we can talk about something that I know a little bit about.
It's up to you. Let's do Trusted Launch real quick. So Trusted Launch is a new capability that's available specifically for Generation 2, Gen 2 virtual machines in Azure. And it gives you a way to do things like have a secure boot for your virtual machines, including having access to things like verified bootloaders, drivers, kind of every step of the life cycle of a virtual machine booting within the hypervisor and getting that up and running. So what this is it lets you, for every virtual machine that you configure that's a Gen 2 virtual machine, you can choose to do a couple different things with it when you configure it. And this is a preview feature. It's available in the portal today. So if you want to go create a new VM and try some of this out, you can. You get the capability to turn on things like Secure Boot. So Secure Boot, what that does is it's all implemented in platform firmware, right? So directly on the host and kind of part of the Azure fabric. What it does is it protects you against the injection or installation of, say, like a rootkit or a bootkit on VM boot. So you'll make sure that when you boot this virtual machine, like you have the assurance that every time that that machine boots, it can only boot from signed operating systems and drivers that are allowed. So you can think of it as like having basically an entire chain of trust down to some, like if you're thinking like certificates down, like trusting down to like a root CA. Same way here, right? You have a root of trust for that software stack on your VM. So any of the OS boot components, it could be the bootloader, a kernel driver, all those things have to be signed by trusted publishers. And then anything that wasn't signed by a trusted publisher, like say like a piece of malware came along with a boot kit and it tried to inject itself into that chain, it wouldn't be able to do it because it wasn't signed and trusted. And in that case, your VM's just not going to be allowed to boot. So you can kind of have that as a knob or a lever, right? A thing that you can pivot on along the way. The other thing that this brings is support for trusted platform modules, TPMs, specifically virtual TPMs. They're compliant with the TPM spec, TPM 2.0, I believe. Now you can have access to this capability as well. So now you've gone and you can do things like measure the entire boot chain. So everything on the VM from UEFI to your operating system, all the way through to the system booting up, any drivers that need to load along the way there. And then you can do things like integrate your VTPM booting into Azure Security Center and, you know, say something did pop in that chain, you could issue an integrity alert. So you would see the alert in ASC and then you would have the details on any of those components that just didn't pass an integrity check along the way.
Question with the VTPM, because you look at that, like TPM I know is used for the Windows 10 encryption. I'm completely blanking on
BitLocker.
So in this scenario, you're probably not needing VTPM for BitLocker because everything's already encrypted. But I'm guessing like this VTPM would also help if somebody got access to your storage account that has your OS disk in it, grab that OS disk and tried to spin up that VM in a different environment based on that OS disk, that it would start failing those integrity checks because different environment, different components. Is that where some of the VTPM stuff could help?
And then you'll get the alert for it. So it's bringing support for measured boot with attestations along the way. So say you had like a piece of anti-malware software that you were running that's looking for that level of support.
Yep.
And can do things like measure your boot components as you're coming up, right? So your VM boots and then your anti-malware software comes along and it looks attestation log and it says, hey, was there a component that was trustworthy or not trustworthy? And then should we issue an alert or, you know, just what does that look like for us along the way? Like us as consumers, like how do we want to action that? So you get the alert in ASC and you'll see the component that was that malicious component, right? Whatever it happened to be, whether it was like malicious, like a piece of malware or somebody installed something that wasn't from a trusted or signed publisher or anything like that. So that's all out there. And then because this trusted launch capability is kind of native to the Azure Fabric, you do get all those additional integrations with things like Security Center and Azure Defender as well, which is kind of cool and kind of nifty.
Yeah, I was looking through all of this and there's a lot. This one article that has an overview in deploying the portal, there's a lot to soak in that one article. It's not a super long one, but there's just a lot of details there around how this works and different things you can do with it and different integrations. This is a nice feature that you could probably spend a lot of time playing with and figuring out all the different aspects to it.
It's not needed by everybody. But again, in that spirit of choice, like if this is something you've been looking for or it's been holding you back from going to the cloud because you feel like for whatever reason, like you're not trusting the attestations that are coming out of things like the Trust Center or you're looking for additional capabilities like virtual TPMs, like, hey, now you have this available to you. So there are like caveats, right? preview service, all those kinds of things, early days. It is also specifically only available for Gen 2 VMs. So it's not going to be available for every VM series and every VM size that's out there. You still don't have capabilities in Azure like this. This is bringing some capabilities of like on-prem Hyper-V with Gen 2 VMs. So things like Secure Boot, the VTPM, also virtualization-based security or VBS. It is not bringing support today for shielded VMs, VHDX formats, things like that. So your mileage may vary in what you're looking for and how you choose to adopt that. And then specifically, like, there are some limitations too. Like, it's for Gen 2 VMs, not all Gen 2 VMs. OS support, it might not be covered for, like, say, your flavor of Linux today. And regional availability is also limited. So at least during kind of this stage of the preview, regional availability is South Central US and North Europe. But the cool thing is...
Our favorite region, Scott, South Central.
Hey, South Central has availability zones now. It's better. And North Europe is Dublin, right? Like, that's a big region. It's a great place to be.
I was going to say, certain features aren't supported too that they call out there, like a whole bunch of them. Backup, Azure Site Recovery, Shared Image Gallery, Ephemeral OS Disk, Shared Disk, Manage Image, Azure Dedicated Host. I'm guessing some of that is because you're securing the boot process and some of those can mess with boot processes or restoring from some of those backups. There's some things to think about there. So be aware certain features are unsupported.
From the pricing perspective, no additional cost to existing VM pricing.
So if you
want to try it out and play with it, like, hey, it's a good thing.
For sure. But yes, like you said, definitely some of those initial preview type limitations to it. So go read the documentation. Don't do it in production. Disclaimer, disclaimer, disclaimer.
all the things. As usual, caveats abound. If you want to play with it, it is out there and available. I believe there were also some sessions at Ignite that if they didn't take deep dives on this stuff, they did at least mention it, you know, for more than 10 seconds. I think Aaron Chappelle's kind of compute overview session had some things about that in there, and maybe take a look through the Ignite catalog and see if there's any others.
Yeah, and we can do some quick searching too and see. Maybe we'll throw a few in the show notes if we can come up with a couple of those sessions as well. And with that, I think I have a meeting coming up or I have focus time. Either way, Alexa's yelling at me that I have something.
Well, we don't want to deny Alexa her ability to yell at you.
No. Oh, it's just focus time. Alexa was just telling me I need to go focus. I have that every time. I need to move that back later or tell Alexa not to remind me or just not have a reminder 15 minutes before my focus time. But yes, good episode. Cool stuff coming. Thanks again. Enjoy your weekend.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben. We'll talk to you next week.
Talk to you later, Scott.
If you enjoyed the podcast, go leave us a 5-star rating in iTunes. It helps to get the word out so more IT pros can learn about Office 365 and Azure. If you have any questions you want us to address on the show or feedback about the show, feel free to reach out via our website, Twitter, or Facebook. Thanks again for listening and have a great day.